Hey, what's up, guys? It's your host, Lopez, and I just want to say thank you for tuning into this episode today. If you're on Facebook and want to show some support with a like on the page, you can find it by going to facebook.com/behindcloseddoorspodcast or just searching Behind Closed Doors Podcast. You can also find it on Twitter at the BCD Podcast and on Instagram at the Behind Closed Doors Podcast. Last but not least, follow the podcast on Spotify by searching Behind Closed Doors in the podcast section to see all the amazing upcoming interviews I have to come. Every Sunday, I post a picture of a band with a hint of who my next guest is. Then on Tuesday, I post a brief clip from our video interview with a good highlight of our conversation we had. And lastly, post the new episode up on Spotify every Thursday morning. Now, on to the episode. Alrighty, so we got Christian Machado, former El Nino. Now he does his own solo project. How the fuck are you doing today, brother?
Doing good, man. Getting by and, surviving the crazy world nowadays, I guess, you know?
Right, for sure.
2021 seems like a good continuation of 2020. Just now we can maybe laugh about some things a little bit more.
Yeah, things are starting to ease up just a little bit, finally.
Sure.
First thing I want to start off by saying with everybody, I just want to say thank you for taking the time with talking to me today. Definitely a huge fan of yours. First time I seen you guys going crazy was the music video for How Can I Live? It was on Freddy vs. Jason. I seen it on the special features, and I remember being about probably 10, 11, or 12 around that time frame, and just seeing you guys just rocking out with the dreads, just thinking, this is fucking crazy. This is amazing. So definitely a huge fan, longtime fan with you guys. Where did you grow up at, and where are you from originally?
Well, I'm South American. I was born in Brazil, raised in Uruguay and Venezuela. Most of my childhood I spent in Venezuela, growing up till about the age of 12, 13 is when my family moved to the United States. I was pretty much a South American kid doing regular South American things, you know, like playing soccer and definitely swimming in the ocean a lot when I was a kid. I grew up near the ocean, so I'm like an ocean baby. I now live about an hour, 45 minutes from the ocean, but, you know, getting back there.
Are you living on the coast right now?
Yeah, I'm in Cali. I'm California? About 45 minutes from San Diego.
Nice, man. What all do you guys do for fun out that way?
Where I'm at is actually an area that's considered Southern California wine country. Okay. And I don't drink at all. You know, unless like a friend forces me because it's like it's 50th birthday or something.
Right.
You know, I'm not allergic to it. I just don't do it. But I live in an area that's really beautiful. It has a lot of wineries and it's a dry, somewhat of a California desert kind of feel, but we're still close enough to San Diego where we still have big trees and, you know, some humidity and I'm close enough to the beach, you know, and I love living in the state because of the weather. The people are laid back. Depends where you go. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend like inner LA right now is a disaster. You know, the inner cities are really not taking care of a lot of homeless people there. But, you know, there are still many beautiful areas in California that I would recommend anyone to live in for sure.
What's the weather like out that way right now?
Right now, let's see. Today, all week, it's between 70 and 45. pretty much.
Jeez. We'll compare. So for me, I'm in a town called Wanata, Indiana. It's the northern part of Indiana, close towards Chicago. Today, the high was a total of 12, feels like 0 degrees outside, and we got snow all throughout the day. And the lowest it's going to be this week is a high of 9 degrees on Wednesday.
Oh my God. I mean, you're definitely in it, man. You're like, what's that show, Surviving Alaska. You're pretty much just, you might as well just start filming your own Surviving Indiana show. Bro.
Yeah. It gets pretty gnarly out here.
I lived in New Jersey for a while.
You got a good feel of it.
But it's not that bad there. You know, I mean, you get your cold days here, your cold days there, but it's not as bad as I know it gets, like in Missouri and Indiana, you know, where in the middle of the country, that middle America frostbite could just lose a finger.
Yeah, dude, especially because I'm not that far off, like I said, from Illinois and Michigan. So like when we get snow, lake effect snow, it's like really thick snow and a lot of it. And it just causes blizzards and people just tend to not learn how to drive again all over. And it's a pretty interesting time of the year when this time of year comes around, especially in February when we get most of the snow. It seems like it's been delayed the past couple of years. You know, it keeps on pushing back. And I know last year it snowed as early as on Halloween. It was snowing on Halloween last year in Indiana. So all the kids didn't really get to go trick-or-treating. And 2 years ago, I should say, and then the previous year, just this last Halloween, you know, the pandemic was going on. So there was a lot of upset there for the past 2 years with Halloween. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's not no 70 degree weather.
Yeah, no, I mean, dude, the coldest weather I've ever experienced. And I mean, I've been to Siberia. I toured Siberia. You know, I did like a 7-8 show tour of just northern Russia. But the one climate that sticks with me always is being in Chicago by the lake, you know, like where you're really experiencing that winter great big humidity, where it's not just cold, it's humid cold that will go through a down jacket, even if you have one on. And I remember thinking, having a down jacket and thinking, this thing used to save me in New York, New Jersey, you know, like it was, I'd be able to put that thing on, throw it on top and pretty much maneuver without it being too cold. And I remember in Chicago, you know, walking on the bridges over the rivers and freezing my ass off.
Yeah, it's cold out there, dude. It definitely bites you. Especially that's why they call it the Windy City, man. Just thought that when that wind picks up and that cold gust gets you, dude, it feels like you're getting hit with a hammer. It's just so blistering cold. It's
is the U.S. having generally a cold winter this winter, would you say?
Yes, yeah, because there's even in Texas, we have family on my wife's side of the family that lives in Texas, and they're getting – there's actually a big old accident on a highway out there. There was some freezing rain out there. Dude, yeah, it's cold over that way. I don't know what's going on this year. It's crazy.
Yeah. My parents sent me some pictures from New Jersey, and they had gotten snow, a couple of feet of snow or something like that. I remember the good old days of digging out of snow, man, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, in New York, New Jersey, it's tough living in the snow because there isn't many garages to park cars and not a lot of parking. And what happens when it snows is they have to start alternating sides parking because the snow vehicles need to come and pick up the snow and stuff. Yeah. Piles. Man, I can at least 30, 40 times I've had to dig my car out of snow because the snow mobiles just pretty much covered it.
And that's the thing that sucks about it, man. You can't really sell cars around unless you keep them grass kept around this time of year because all the salt and calcium they lay down in this time of year just cakes on the side of the cars and it just causes rust, you know. And that's why a lot of people buy cars from down south or they go on the coast and they get cars because there's not that, you know, they don't have that problem around this time of year and they garage keep if they keep it over this way, you know. But we got a lot of struggles.
The East Coast weather totally destroys cars too.
Does it really? Well,
the bad roads, the salt on the road.
I was gonna say the salty, yeah.
You know? Man, salt, I remember yeah. I mean, I remember driving on the Cross Bronx Expressway once, bro, with my car doing like 70 or 65, and just, it was like like potholes everywhere. And, you know, it's I guess part of living in New York City, you know. And now I live out here where everything's a highway and a freeway, and you know, everything's straight, and there are no potholes on the roads in California, you know.
Oh, that's crazy out here, because you know, like for this time of year, all the plow trucks going over, they don't care if there's already a little bit of pothole. They go right over that with that big ass heavy blade. It just cracks a bigger hole than it was before, and they just keep on rolling.
Yeah, for sure. Snow, the snow can kill the roads, man. That in turn will kill the car. The mechanics are making bank just laughing their ass off, you
The
know. Yeah.
state's making a whole lot of money. Yeah. The state is too over here, because they got to plow these roads and whatnot, you know, lay all that salt and calcium down. They're making good money too.
Sure.
So, what got you to wanting to be a front man? What kind of influences did you have to like really want you to start to sing?
Well, I mean, I started fronting in bands little by little through the death metal scene. I was in the New York, New Jersey death metal scene for a while when I, from the age of, I don't know, I want to say like 18 to 23 or something, you know. For a few years, I was just hanging in the death scene, playing bass in bands pretty much. I was in a black metal band called Deteriorat at the time, playing bass and like doing backup vocals. And then I went on to sing in a death metal band called Solemn at the time. These are all bands that may be around. I think Deteriorat is still around, but I don't know if Solemn is around still or not. But I pretty much got into, you know, singing, being a front man through screaming, you know, in death metal bands. But I had always liked singing, you know, since a kid, and I would always sing and play guitar and stuff like that. But I didn't become like a rock front man at first. I became like a brutal singer, vocalist, whatever. And ultimately, I just wound up finding my way back to the things I did as a kid, which was regular singing, you know. It was something that was inspired in me through other metal bands. You know, I had to first become screamer and then see other screamers that were able to sing, like Bert from Fear Factory. He was a big influence on me as far as trying to find, you know, my own things that might be a little bit more personal. So that's where pretty much the singing, screaming, bilingual kind of thing came out of, was just out of being inspired by singers like Bert from Fear Factory or Maynard from Tool.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
You know, Max and Sepultura, you know, who didn't do a screaming singing, but he did like a screaming, talking, tribal kind of voice. And also like a Brandon Boyd from Incubus, who I
Yeah.
was a great vocalist at the time. And you know, just by being inspired, I kind of found my way into this, oh, okay, Latin singing, bilingual, screaming, melodic singing and kind of talk rapping, maybe.
Yeah, man, definitely. Yeah, I know. Like, I was just interviewing a guy, and there's definitely, you can tell there's cultural differences between US bands, or not even really a US band, like somebody that, like for your example, you weren't born and raised in the US. You can definitely tell just through your style of singing and vocals that you have some cultural difference. Like bands like Amon Amarth, if you've ever heard of the band Amon Amarth, they're what is called what is it, Viking metal. And you can definitely tell that they're not from the US. And bands like Opeth, the Swedish band, you can definitely tell that they're not US. And I think that's just crazy, you know, that you're just your cultural difference can really show your its true colors just through your vocals. And that's definitely what makes you stand out. And it's very interesting to hear, you know, the type of stuff, especially like with your solo stuff, which I'll get back into later on, but like your solo stuff that I checked out, very interesting stuff.
Thank you, man.
Not a problem, brother.
It's definitely, you know, it's a leap from what I was doing before, but really melodically, it's everything that I was doing before, because a lot of the songs and melodies and chord structure in El Nino was written, well, I mean, in the early days, was written by me. So I just, you know, continued doing something that felt familiar, but, you know, I'm doing it without all the candy wrapper about it. You know, it's just really just songs and chord structures and trying to tell a story. But it's great that, you know, someone like you that listens to heavy music can listen to it and still get what it is, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, man. It's trying to think of a good example with that too. Like, good example, I guess, would be like Slipknot with Corey Taylor. You know, he doesn't just do everything heavy metal. Like, he has his own project now called CMFT, and that's totally different from Slipknot, you know, heavy in your face, fast paced. And then there's songs like Snuff, where it's like a slow, you know, nothing really too heavy with that song at all. And I think it's awesome when bands can do the best of both worlds, let alone with just one vocalist. You know, if it's two vocalists, you know, more power to you, and, you know, the more the merrier. But I think it's really cool when one guy can pull it off in a band, and they can really do this type of genre, and then they can really do, you know, a whole different spectrum. And that's the type of stuff I really seek and look forward for, as far as like when I find new bands, is I kind of seek for people that can do it all in one shot.
Right on. That's cool, man. Yeah, so definitely. There's definitely a lot of cool culture in metal, though. You know, of it down does it their own way.
Yeah.
Skindred does it their own way. And, you know, I think back then I was just trying to figure out how to culturally do something cool.
Yeah, for sure, man. So El Nino, was that the band that you had the longest stretch with out of all the bands you've been with?
Yeah, absolutely.
How many years were you with them?
About 20 years. I founded, co-founded, and, you know, did about 8 records with the band, I think. Like 20 years, something like that.
So how did the band come together?
The band had come together pretty much out of a few local musicians in the New York, New Jersey area. Dave, myself, and at the time, a pre-El Nino was El Nino, which was more of like a New York hardcore band, but it had Jorge Rosado in it. And also a friend of mine that I brought into the band called Mark Rizzo. That's kind of like how the band formed. In the very, very early stages of El Nino, it was pretty much Dave and I that were calling the shots. You know, he was doing business aspects of the band, and I was doing all the songwriting, pretty much. It's kind of like how the I guess, business creative team had come together that ultimately grew into what was the full band. But, you know, we just came out of the scene, pretty much. Different musicians and different bands that knew each other. There wasn't any of, like, this big mystery. We didn't, like, go to school together. We weren't, like, lifelong friends or anything. I had been friends with Mark for a while, but not, like, lifelong. I grew up in another country, you know?
Right.
But we just came out of the scene. We wanted to do something, and, you know, I think the thing that allowed us to do what we did was definitely the songs that we had. The creative element was always number one foremost. And then the business element came around after different labels saw that we were getting attention locally in the region. You know, they started becoming attracted to the band, and really we signed a record deal. And from there, really, it was out of our hands. It was a lot of it was left in Roadrunner Records hands, and they were the ones that really put this amazing, you know, speedball effect on what we did. And they weren't full believers in the band at first, but as soon as the record came out and some people were paying attention and the records were selling, they saw that there was something about it that they needed to kind of stick with and believe in.
Right. Yeah. It definitely gave them that ump, you know, like, I guess that's with any record label, with the new band that they just signed, you know, they're definitely taking a leap of faith on that. And then once they get that one album that really sells and it gives them that confidence, then I guess that takes the weight off their shoulders. You know, I guess that's just with any band.
Yeah. It was, you know, it's what all any label would do. You know, if you have 10 bands, you gotta give them all an equal love, put exactly. it out, and see how the fans, you know, digest it and what to really push harder with. And, you know, not and it's not to minimize what other bands that maybe aren't selling as many records are doing, but at least the label will know if we push hard with this band, we'll start seeing return here, return that we can now invest into the other bands that maybe need a little bit more help with marketing and things like that, you know?
Definitely.
I think that the model that Roadrunner Records had for heavy music back then, you know, is the model that we see across every single smaller independent label or major label with a smaller independent arm of a label doing now. You know, Roadrunner Records pretty much laid out the law for how you break a heavy band.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Now, are you a Spotify guy or are you an iTunes guy?
I am an iTunes guy.
iTunes, okay. So
I think only because I've been an Apple baby my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of hard to break from being an Apple, because I know Apple was, you know, obviously came around before Spotify, but I never personally, I was always Android. So I guess that kind of steered me to when I found Spotify, that kind of, you know, I never really toyed around with iTunes, but I know on Spotify right now, the song I Am Loco has the most popularity via streaming numbers. It's sitting at about 8 million streams currently. What, in your opinion, makes that song so popular about it?
Well, that song, you know, it needs to be said that that song was written by me and Omar Rodriguez, who was at the time a great friend of mine. All right, so that song's on Revolution. On Revolution, we wanted some certain sample sounds there. At first, Dave had hired Chris from Bile, from the band Bile, which mm-hmm. is a popular New York City industrial band. And, you know, he had done a few synthy things that we thought were cool, but we were definitely looking for more aggressive industrial urban sounds. We wanted to blend, at least in my head, I wanted to blend, you know, the industrial sound of like a sound you hear like on Fear Factory Body Hammer mm-hmm. With like more urban elements of things, you know? And Omar kind of got that. So I pretty much convinced the entire band to just let Omar be the, you know, sample maker, weird sound guy. Cause you know, in those days, everybody needed a weird sound guy. And, you know, they let me go with it, you know. After Omar and I wrote I Am Loco, they realized how imperative he could be to the element of what the band was about to become, you know. And that song wouldn't have been written without Omar's sample, which he gave to me. As like, check this out, dom dom do dom dom do 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 dom dom, you know, and I'm like, fuck, I could write a whole song around this. This is easy.
Right,
you
know? Right.
So I pretty much did that. That's what that song became, you know, and we pretty much played it the way it was written. Maybe we rearranged a few couple of things, but right, you know. Right. Shout out Omar Rodriguez in Union City doing his thing, you know.
Hell yeah.
Just being like a local kid with an ear for aggressive industrial sounds and a lover of hip hop really is what it was.
So now my personal favorite is How Can I Live, which is at 12 million streams on Spotify. And the music video for that is sitting at 7.3 million streams. And it was also featured, like I said earlier, on Freddy vs. Jason. What's the story behind that song?
Well, that song came about in a couple of parts from what I remember. The intro riff, which was something that I think Jardel had. The bass line, which is something that was written... I think Bob Marlette and Laz, came to the bass line. And then the chorus sections, which were chords that were written by me and Mark. Mark Rizzo and I had pretty much the chorus. So that song kind of had like a group vibe on it, you know?
Yeah.
Lyrically, the song was written about my father and in my search for who do I think my father is. I had never met my father at the time. And, you know, him and I barely had begun to communicate at that time. There was no internet. There wasn't like you could go on Facebook and find people.
Right.
And when we came to the Americas, the connection between my mother's family and my father's family completely fell apart. And for many years, we didn't know where he was or even if he was alive, you know?
Yeah.
But during that time, I had begun to make contact with my father and, you know, find out. I wanted to learn what it was that him and I would share and have in common. And in return, I found out that we were alike in incredibly different amount of ways that I would have never thought. Even though I never met him, I wasn't conditioned by anything that had to do with him. And were we two different people? Sure. But it says a lot about, I guess, inner psychology and, you know, personal reaction, how you are, I guess, conditioned or raised to react by different people, you know? So it taught me a lot about life and how different life can be depending on who you're with and who you spend your life with. And I would never look back on anything. I think that my mother was amazing to me and bringing me to America and allowing me to have the life that I've had, you know. Without her actually taking that leap, I could even go back further and say without my grandmother, who was a Polish refugee, escaped from Nazi-controlled Poland at the time, without her, like, making the leap and leaving Poland and
going
to Israel and then going to South America and meeting my grandfather and all, you know. So it's definitely something that it's a song that speaks of the differences that my father and I had, but also the similarities, despite not ever having met each other.
How did that end up in the long run? Did you guys ever?
Yeah, we did meet actually. And, you know, it was when we met, it was amazing. I was about maybe 32 years old or something like that. I'm not 100% sure, but we met and, you know, it was an amazing moment in my life. I was able to, you know, meet this dude that was pretty much, you know, the musician that I grew out of. You know, my father was a musician and I always knew as a kid he had been a musician, even though I hadn't been communicating with him. So to meet, you know, and discuss music in a way like if we were both like the same fans of music was something else. You know, and he passed away since then, but I'm very grateful I got to make the contact, you know, and communicate finally get to meet him. And a lot of it was filmed, actually. It was filmed. And maybe some days I'll get the films. But it was unfortunate what happened. It was a camera crew was there, captured everything, captured my dad coming to the show for the first time. It was amazing. But because of the terrible business dealings, you know, the film crew was never paid.
Oh,
something okay. That was completely out of my hands. And
so they kind of kept on to it then?
Yeah. Yeah. Now that I departed the band, I think there's a good shot that I may be able to get the film footage. I hope I can someday.
Absolutely, dude. Especially after, you know, saying that he passed, that's definitely something that if I was, you know, in that situation, I'd be doing anything and everything I could to get my hands on that. Cause that's just a piece of gold right there. You know, that's crazy.
Someday, I'll grab it someday. Eventually.
Right, exactly, absolutely. Now, with that being on Freddy versus Jason, how did you guys get approached for that?
That was the great work of the licensing team at Roadrunner Records. You know, at the time, and I imagine now, most big labels have their own licensing teams.
Yeah.
You know, where they're actively seeking everyday placement for songs. Now, that's more imperative now more than ever, you know? So at the time, most of the licensing was soundtrack licensing. You know, there was not really like internet and a lot of advertisements. I mean, especially for a band like ours, it's not like we were going to be in a car commercial.
You know? Right, right.
So movies were the big part of what the licensing teams at record labels were actively seeking every day, placement in movie soundtracks. And Roadrunner Records was responsible for putting the soundtrack together, and they heard the song, loved it, played it for the people at New Line Cinema. They loved it. It was easy as that. It really was as easy as, you know, 3-4 people that make the decisions, making a decision on a song. And it just happened to be us.
That's awesome. Was the music video kind of based around the movie then, or was that kind of your guys' own idea?
It was based around the video a little bit, yeah. Okay. And it was, I forget the name of the director, but he had done the Korn Make Me Bad video and a couple other Korn videos. And
Oh, okay. You
know, what he did just looked awesome. The lighting always looked cool. And
yeah,
it was always like cool, like cinematic flares in his videos. And we were like, we want that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Like, I thought, you know, with it being with that new 2000s style horror movies, and especially being Freddy vs. Jason, that's been a long awaited film for horror fans, you know. And then seeing that kind of atmosphere on that music video, kind of had an idea that, you know, maybe that's, they're kind of, you know, they're stoked that they got a part on the soundtrack, so why not make a music video kind of based around the actual type of the movie? Because, you know, that's definitely, it's like it's a good special feature to be able to see, you know, a song, a killer song on top of a killer music video based around that type of, you know, movie and the genre of horror. So yeah, I thought, you know.
And the fact that they put the movie at the song at the end of the movie, it wasn't just a single for
yeah,
the song.
Yeah. I remember that
at the end of the movie, I think a lot of people really heard it. A lot of people, I think, learned about the band because of that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Because yeah, I think you're in the movie theater, you're, you know, the ending credits, it shows, you know, Jason walking out with Freddy's head, gets a wink, and then the song starts to play. Everybody's going to hear that. You know, that's when everyone starts to get up or, you know, what have you. But everybody hears that very last song of a movie. And yeah, dude, that was pretty cool. I remember that. Like,
and the great thing is that that song wasn't written for any movie, you know. It was written for my dad, you know, and the complete disconnection and similarities and the beautiful disconnections and the ugly similarities.
Right, exactly.
And the fact that Roadrunner Records managed to get it on that soundtrack is, it really goes to say a lot about having a great team behind you. It really does.
Yeah, definitely.
Or a team that realizes, yeah, this song has nothing to do with this, but this would actually fit really good with
it. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I had to ask what the song was about, because I whenever I interview everybody, I do kind of just, you know, a quick run through to see what it's about. And there was actually somebody had put out there that it wasn't based on what you said, you know, like you had got to meet him and all that good stuff. It was actually saying that he had passed away. Then that's why you wrote the song. So I'm glad that I get to do this clarification with everybody and kind of get, you know, a good idea of what things are really about.
Sure.
So how about shows? What was an El Nino show all about for anybody that never saw them with you?
The band shows were all about bands that we were inspired by in the New York hardcore scene. Without a doubt, our shows were a New York hardcore band performance. It's just we weren't playing hardcore. We were playing like modern metal.
Just very energetic.
Culture and metal.
Yeah.
But we came out of that New York hardcore scene, so we were inspired by all those bands.
Yeah, you still had them roots. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, we pretty much admired bands like Agnostic Front, Cro-Mags, Sick of It All, Life of Agony. You know, even New York bands that were dark and still had a hardcore element, like Typo Negative. Like,
yeah.
I loved bands like that, you know? Bands that were unique, that sounded really, really unique, too. When you listen to the Cro-Mags, they sound nothing like Sick of It All. When you listen to Sick of It All, they sound nothing like Life of Agony. And there was just a really cool originality, you know, in the New York heavy music scene, hardcore scene, whatever you want. In the New York music scene in general.
What's the best tour that you've done, in your opinion?
Like the best, most fun tour that I'll always remember as the most fun tour will be the Jägermeister tour, because I had my good friends there with me the whole time. You know, I had the guys from 40 Below Summer who were my really good friends. We lived, you know, a mile from each other. Came up in the same music scene. And also Dave Williams, who really, really had become a great personal friend and a huge supporter of everything we did, you know? So that tour to me was just the most fun because it was the beginning of our career. We weren't blinded by everything yet. We were getting amazing support from our label and from our peers in the music industry, but we were doing what we wanted to do.
Now, when you
feel like shortly after that, things started changing rapidly, and you know, for certain reasons, things change.
Now, when you were doing tours back, when you were doing tours back then, towards the ending of your run with El Nino, what differences do you think, or what, how has the band changed from then into what it is now?
It was a huge, huge, drastic change. In the beginning, we always had exterior managers to handle things and to make sure that things were at least on paper running smoothly. And then, you know, after the first couple of albums, the band started working more internally and being managed internally. And from there, everything turned into a disaster. Everything.
Sorry to hear that, man. When you were on tour, what was a day like for you in the life of Christian? When you guys were on tour, I know every band and every artist has their different, you know, their routines that they do and whatnot. So what was it like for you when you were, you know, behind the scenes on tour and everything?
Sure. Well, touring is one of those things that, you know, you're having to adapt daily to different types of things, but most of the tasks can become monotonous. Like the things like waiting for the show can be monotonous. Being with the same people every single day can be monotonous, you know? But to me, touring was its best when you're on stage, really. You know, there's no other way to describe it. It's, you live 22 and a half hours a day for that 1.5 hour on stage. It's the way it works. Really, there was some things, sometimes it was a little glamorous, but a lot of times there was nothing glamorous about it. And, you know, the venues could be great one day, and then the next day there's no shower in the venue and you don't have a hotel room.
Right.
So you like give yourself a baby wipe shower because that's what you're going to do. Or, you know, there's nowhere good to eat nearby and there isn't a budget to get a taxi and go do, you know, or you're not making enough money to go somewhere to get a good meal.
Right.
Like, so there's like, those things can become like, oh wow, it's can be rough out here. But, you know, if you're a couple levels above that, you could have consistent comfort, you know? And the important thing about touring, I think, is that the 1.5 hour on stage is so exhilarating that really becomes about balancing the rest of your day so that you have a consistent comfort zone so that you can go on stage and just focus for that 1.5 hour every single day.
Absolutely. That's basically what it comes
to. You know, it's almost like if I can just get through comfortably today, I know I'm going to get up on that stage and kill it.
Right.
For an hour and a half. But, you know, if you slept like shit because the bus doesn't have an air conditioner or a heater, or the bus has a leaky roof. I mean, buses, you know, always grateful to be in a bus, but when the bus is like shitty, it could be bad.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. Everything, you know, you eat a meal that wasn't good and then you get a you fucking feel like garbage.
You're still going to go up there. I do remember one time I had like, they wound up having to take me to the hospital after the show was played. Because I just couldn't stop throwing up. Whatever I had eaten, I was like,
throwing up.
It lasted for like 12 hours and the hospital was like, okay, I guess you're not throwing up now. You can go.
What's the craziest thing that you've experienced out on tour, whether it was to you or just something that you saw?
On a tour, I mean, I've seen people get killed on a tour.
No shit.
That's probably one of the biggest memories. It didn't happen at the show, but it had been after the show and we went to, I think it was a Denny's, and just all hell broke loose in there. And there was like a huge gang fight and, you know, people got killed in there without a doubt. Other than that, I mean, I've experienced amazing moments too, you know, like, being able to greet the ashes of someone that was like a lover of the band and had come to all the shows, but had passed away. I've gotten to meet some amazing war veterans that have lost limbs. That really are inspiring stories for anyone, you know, for anyone of any walk of life. Doesn't matter if you're a homeless person or, you know, a CEO of a corporation. And those are the things, and the friends that I've gotten to make, you know, I think are the most enlightening parts of it. The people that I've gotten to meet, I guess the songs brought us, me and some certain people closer together. And, you know, that's kind of like what music does, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. For you, what's one conflict or failure that you faced while being a musician, and what did you do to make a comeback from that?
Well, this one's easy. The biggest conflict failure that I faced as a musician is writing songs that I didn't want to write. Writing songs that I felt were forced by someone else. And I'm not knocking the work that was done. I'm just answering honestly. Right,
exactly.
Was that failing myself creatively? Not saying I draw the line here, I won't do that. Because artistically, I think this is important, not this. Everything else is just a paper-based decision, a facts-based decision, you know? When it comes to the creative element, that's where you have to use intuition a little bit more. And you have to play psychology with hypotheticals, which is completely weird to have to do, but I guess, you know, maybe people that design products do that to get a better product. I don't know. I just did it artistically, creatively, and always tried to do something that had something to offer. And after many years, you know, disagreements or people think people have different visions as to what the band should be doing, that draws people apart. And then you have this mess of creative decisions where there isn't really like as solid of a focus as there was before. So that's the one thing that I regret, you know, not having drawn the line on certain things and not having drawn the line early on certain things, having been the main songwriter.
Sure. You
know, having said, this is where the line is, and unless you know, somebody from the exterior can come in and show me how we could elevate this line. I don't want to try to erase this line because this is what we are. But that's kind of like what happened. And maybe I should have learned how to work with people better. You know, I don't necessarily know what the right answer is, but I know that some things got messy and then albums weren't full of great songs. It was like three great songs and then some other fillers.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where I kind of just, I just started getting a bad taste in my mouth. And I have made the comeback from that by making a solo album in which I think every single song I wrote is really something to offer, whether it's emotionally or musically, you know, for artists that understand this kind of music. And with the heavy band that Aru and Diego and I and a couple of guys from other bands are doing, put a record together where every song sounds like it's a hit.
And this is a new thing that you're talking about, not the solo project?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a new thing. I've kind of talked about it briefly, but not really ready to like say here it is until, you know, the album is fully done.
What's this group going to be called so I can be on the looks for it?
We don't really have a promotable name yet. Let's okay. just say that. We do have 10 songs out of the 12 that are going to be on the album done and pretty much at this point, like close to finally mixed. But, you know, we're just still tinkering with the last couple of songs, making sure it's right. But the way to undo the past is we all said to ourselves, well, we're not going to do that. If we're going to make an album, we're going to make an album where every song sounds like is either an album opener or it'd be like a single. I tried to do something similarly with my acoustic thing, too.
I'm stoked to hear that. That's huge news. I'm real glad you mentioned that. So your departure with the band in 2019, are you able to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. Topically. Yeah. Yeah.
So what
I don't happened? Have anything bad to say anyway, but
right. Yeah.
I think just being disappointed and disengaged from the creative element was one of the main things that led to beginning to ask questions around everything else. And then what wound up occurring is in asking questions, in having been disenchanted with what was going on creatively and now beginning to wonder what is going on with the business, you know, a lot of things came to light that were just, to me personally, unacceptable. So it was either I go or, you know, somebody else goes. And in the end, I wound up saying, okay, I'm going to go.
What was the response that you got from that, from fans and whatnot?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think a lot of the fans were supportive and understood that why I might be leaving. I think that the people that have done their own research or, you know, have realized what has happened, they know why I left the band, you know? And I really received a lot of support from the fans. You know, I'm incredibly grateful and actually blessed that it occurred that way. You know, a lot of the fans could have told me to go fuck myself, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think they felt that, you know, I put in a lot of good years and really gave the band my all. And those first couple of albums were all my songs. So at least the fans still have that. You know,
exactly.
It doesn't even belong to me anymore. I actually will leave my ownership of it to the fans eventually. But, you know, at least I got to do great things, man, you know, and still doing great things and definitely better things, I think, is the more important thing to say.
Now, what's the reaction that you've gotten in the feedback on your most recent 2020 solo stuff that you put out?
The reaction was amazing. You know, I was, again, somehow blessed. You know, I guess the fans that have been with us for so many years really were open-minded fans. You know, they didn't become closed-off individuals. They grew into, You know, they blossomed into this all genre understanding kind of musical being. And their response to my acoustic stuff has been amazing, as well as, you know, my close community of peers. You know, they've all given me amazing, you know, we love your album. You know, the songs are phenomenal. You sound great. And really, you know, it's not like I wasn't trying to make anyone happy other than I was trying to redeem the things that I felt I did wrong in the past. That's really all I was trying. I was trying to make something that I thought I would want to hear. And I think that that's what music is about. You know, music is not about somebody coming into the room and telling you what's cool at the moment. Why don't you try doing that? You know, no. Music is about, you know, make something that you can be proud of. And that in turn will probably make somebody else feeling like they have some kind of endeared emotion to it. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. That's why you hear a lot about fans going up to their, you know, favorite bands after they play a set and they talk about, you know, this certain song really saved me from really, you know, putting the bullet through my head or jumping off that bridge that one day when I really had that terrible day. And I just figured, you know, there's nothing worth it. And that song they listened to really brought them to figure out like maybe there is something worth it. I just need to stick it through it because my favorite artist made a song about it and they went through exactly what I'm feeling now. And they're, you know, they can relate to that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, certain Life of Agony songs, I have those kind of run throughs in my head, you know, being a young, completely confused and just curious person, but not having any answers and feeling like society doesn't have the answers for me.
Absolutely.
But that's, you know, that's the plight of the metalhead though, dude. Here we are metalheads trying to still like, where do we fit into society?
Huh? Yeah, all the time. Like, for example, I wore this shirt to Walmart today. I can't tell you how many confused and upset looks I got. And
I'm sure in Indiana, they're like... They're like, that kid is like cooking cats when he goes home.
Exactly. Yeah. They're like, man, you know, the typical, I bet you can't understand the guy that sings in that band. He needs a hug, this and that. And, you know, really the moral of this shirt is, it's from a band called Dire's Murder. Obviously they're from Australia and this shirt is off of an album cover called Holy War. And it's based off of
that track is phenomenal, by the way,
dude. It's a so you know all about that whole band. It's an album based off of War, not really based off of, but the track is based off of War Through Religion, which is a very true thing. And I'm very, you know, upset with a lot of the fake believers with religion, as far as Christian or any religion, how that goes. You know, like the proof of is. If the matter is what happened years ago with the whole ISIS thing going on, convert to Islam or die. Islam is the, you know, their religion that they praise off of. So if you're telling me if I don't go with your religion or praise that I'm going to get killed, that's a form of hate and war. And I mean, it's just the truth. Yeah,
similarly in other more Western religions, you know, they disconnect from people that aren't within their religious.
Exactly.
You know, mind field, I guess, you know, they really practice like complete disconnection from anyone that doesn't believe like you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which goes back to tribalism. If you really think about it, you know,
I think
it's cool to like know what it is and
yeah. Oh yeah. 100%.
It's probably not smart to live your life by it.
Exactly.
Know?
Exactly. Yeah. It's just like the whole South Park, the movie where they go to hell and then they're like, oh yeah, they said the correct religion was the Muslims or something like that. This is some stupid, silly stuff, you know, but
right.
My last question for you is aside music, what are some of the hobbies that you're into that you like to do?
Well, I'm a father, you know, separated, but I'm a dad.
How old is it, a boy or a girl?
I have two girls.
Two girls? Two girls. What are the AIDS?
Blessed or cursed, I'm not sure. But,
right.
But I'm lucky. They're both awesome. You know,
what's their age?
One's 17 and one is 7. So 10 year gap.
Yeah, that's cool. At least you didn't have a 17 and 15 year old, two teenagers, you know,
fighting. Or like, over. You know, like one right after the other is tough too when you have like two babies.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Some people will say like, oh, but they play together if they're like close in age, but I don't know. I just see more work having to happen.
I got a 2.5 year old. He's going to be 3 here in May. And then I got a tomorrow. It's going to be 7 month old. So it's a little bit of a, you know, the age difference, but it's not too drastically huge, you know, but
right on. I got my hands. But 7 months old is like the perfect enjoy baby age.
Oh, I love it.
Sleep overnight, but they're like cute and they just want to like play and laugh the whole time. That's like the perfect age right there.
Let me get this. My daughter, she slept the first night we had her. It was kind of rocky, you know, she's first, you know, obviously 24 hours in the world, but believe it or not, man, she sleeps all night from 2 days old up until now. She slept all night, maybe get up to eat, you know, once or twice, but she'd go right back to bed and would not make no fuss. And she sleeps up. Dude, we got really lucky with her. Yeah.
Dude, you got Sleeping Beauty with you. If she sleeps that solid, dude.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's very, very, I got real lucky. My son was not like that with my wife. And yeah, we were prepared for the worst, but when she slept all night, you know, I'd ask her, week two, you know, I'd ask her every morning when I get up from work, I'd say, how did she sleep last night? Oh, she slept all night. And then after the third week, I stopped asking because I knew she was on that good routine. And even to this day, amazing. Yeah,
that's amazing. Cool, man. I mean, I didn't get to raise my teen daughter, but I raised, you know, my little one. I was there every single day with her. And I remember, I don't know, maybe it was like, she was 3 months old or 4 months old when she first had her first like solid overnight sleep. And it was like, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that with my son, man. The worst time he literally didn't sleep. It was like almost going on like a 19 to 20 hour period where he didn't sleep. And he was just colicky, fussy, like crazy. So I remember I had to take him in my car, put him in his car seat, and I got down the road and he was already knocked out. And I remember tiptoeing up them steps with him and just quietly putting him down and getting that 4 hour of sleep and thinking,
you know, you didn't want to drive the whole night, man.
Yeah, I should have with how he was. Jeez. Yeah, I don't miss those times, but I definitely at the same time I do, you know, I'll always miss, you know, them being home with me all the time when they're older, you know, like with the 17 year old, and I'll 100% miss these days for sure.
Yeah. No, you're at a good age. With 7 months old is an amazing age, man. I miss when my little one was that old.
And I mean, but, I'm 20.
Other than that, I do productions with people.
Oh, do you? Sweet.
I write songs with people. I do features on people's albums. And I mainly produce is what I do.
So you just stick in the whole music scene then?
Yeah, pretty much.
For sure, man. Well, Christian, before I end this, brother, I just want to say thank you again so much for talking with me today. Like I said, just seeing you guys from Frey vs. Jason, checking out I Am Local, all that stuff, and then recently checking out your solo stuff, and to where we are today talking with you, man, it was definitely a huge honor. Huge fan of yours, and I'm definitely stoked to hear that new project you got coming.
Thank you, brother, for having me on, man. It was a blast talking with you. It was great therapy, that's for sure.
Not a problem, man.
In the world of COVID, we don't get much, you know, hangouts with people anymore.
Right, definitely. Is there anything you want to say to anybody listening before we cut out?
Check out my acoustic album. Go to YouTube, Cristian Machado, no H in Christian. Go to Spotify, Cristian Machado, iTunes, Cristian Machado. Cristian Machado everywhere. You find me.
Everywhere. You'll have to keep. Take care, buddy.
All right, brother. Have a great day, man.
You too.